इको एक कहा औ हा औ हिया ओको इको का आहा इनाहे खुलियाना इमु ओकिया आहा हो कोलो कोलो की इके हानो हानो ओका मुकु आओ ओ हवाई ए नाई माई ए मलियो माई इलोहे इये कलेओ Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye, all persons having any business before this Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give your attention and you shall be heard.
Please call the case.
Case number SCWC-21-0000478, State of Hawaii versus Kumulipo Eva Coyote Silva, arguing for the petitioner, Kumulipo Eva Coyote Silva, William H. Jameson Jr., arguing for the respondent, the State of Hawaii, Richard B. Rost. Argument on the
merits. Good morning. Aloha, everyone. Our proceeding today is being broadcast live on the Judiciary's YouTube channel as well as on Olelo, and we apologize for the brief delay in starting our argument. I'd like to welcome our substitute justices, Judge Henry Nakamoto and Judge James Kawashima. Thanks to both of them for being with us. During the proceeding, if a justice has a question, they'll raise their hand virtually and I'll call upon them at the earliest opportunity. At this point, I'd like to ask our attorneys to introduce themselves in the order in which they'll be arguing.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court. William Jameson on behalf of the petitioner in this case, Kumulipo Silva.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, Associate and Substitute Justices. Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Richard B. Rost for the State of Hawaii.
All right, thank you, Mr. Rost. Just to confirm, we have 30 minutes for both sides for your arguments today. Mr. Jameson, we're going to give you a warning with 5 minutes to go. Oh, so you can save that time for rebuttal. Mr. Rost, we're also going to give you a warning at 25 minutes into your argument so you know that the 30 minutes is coming. And at the end of your allotted time, you'll see a light and you'll hear a tone. Mr. Jameson, please proceed with your argument.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Good morning again. There are three issues before the court this morning, which I'd like to identify, and I will discuss them in the order presented. The issues are, first, whether the ICA gravely erred in holding that the trial court did not err in excluding Dr. Blinder's testimony that Silva was not a bad man who goes around hurting people. That's issue number one. Issue number two, whether the ICA gravely erred in holding that the trial court did not err in excluding Dr. Blinder's testimony that to a reasonable degree of medical probability, there does not appear to be a rational basis for Silva's actions, and but for Silva's psychotic illness, he would not have taken the life of this man. Issue number three is whether the ICA gravely erred in holding that no reasonable juror could have concluded that the trial court was instructing them to disregard Dr. Blinder's entire answer explaining how he formed his opinion that Silva lacked substantial capacity to appreciate the wrongfulness of his conduct or to conform his conduct to the requirements of the law. And finally, whether the ICA gravely erred in holding that the trial court did not err in failing to instruct the jury that if they found Silva guilty of manslaughter based on extreme mental or emotional disturbance, they must then consider the insanity defense. Now, beginning with issue number one, my understanding, and I think what the ICA indicated and why they gravely erred, is the way to understand this issue is this way. I believe that the question of whether or not Silva was not a bad man who goes around hurting people was essential to the defense in this case. And the reason it was essential to the defense in this case is because it was a way of it was consistent with what I would say is Dr. Blinder's explanatory style, how he wanted the jury to understand why he concluded that Mr. Silva was not criminally responsible for what he had done in this case. And by that I mean, it appears that what Dr. Blinder was telling the jury is that he was trying to discount his initial belief that this was the best explanation was the mental illness. So in order to discount that, the theory, what Dr. Blinder felt it was necessary to do is, look, I think that the best explanation for why he committed this homicide is the delusions that he was suffering from. But before I will say that, I will try to disprove it. The way to disprove it logically is to look for some other trigger other than the mental illness that has nothing to do with the mental illness, like maybe an insult, maybe a longstanding grudge, or maybe a theft.
Mr. Jameson, the question of whether he's a bad man or not, is that really relevant to the inquiry under the 704-400? Doesn't it sort of get into the terrain of character evidence or evidence? It's just an issue that seems far afield from the actual issue. I think that was the judge's basis for striking it. How do you see that testimony as relevant and not misleading or confusing to the jury, whether he's a good man or a bad man?
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Yes, I must admit, when I first looked at and I glanced at the excerpt that witnessed an issue here, where Dr. Blinder said he's not a bad man who goes around hurting people, the first thing that leaped to my mind, hey, this is character evidence. And as a general rule, character evidence is inadmissible. And I think, believe that is what the ICA relied upon in this case. He said the reason the trial judge did not err in striking the testimony is precisely what I said. He said 404A. 404A does in fact say that generally speaking, character evidence is not admissible. However, if you look at 404A1, character evidence is admissible if it is pertinent and is introduced by the defense. Now, this statement, he's not a bad man who goes around hurting people, to begin with, is being introduced by the defense, namely the Ms. Dr. Blinder, who was testifying for the defense. The question is why? Why is it pertinent? Because if it is pertinent to the defense, to his explanation, then under 404A1, it is admissible that by the terms of the rule. So if we ask, was it pertinent to this case, whether or not there was a history of Mr. Silva going around hurting other people. The way it is very pertinent is in this respect. If, like Dr. Blinder, you start off, you look at this case, you say the best explanation is the mental illness. It seems to explain the homicide in this case. To be try and persuade the jury that that's a reliable opinion, the best way to do it is to try to disconfirm it, right? There has to be, maybe I'll look for some other explanation that has nothing to do with the mental illness. And if I can find that, then I feel more confident. And if I cannot find that, I should say, then I'd be more confident that I'm correct. That the reason that he is, not to be held responsible is because there is no other explanation.
Mr. Jameson, now, we have questions from Justice McKenna and then Justice Seddons. Justice McKenna, your question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Mr.
Jameson, I thought your cert application was based, not really focused so much on the fact that the judge struck the testimony of that he was not a bad man who goes around hurting people. Putting that aside, I thought your cert was raising the fact that the judge actually, although the objection was apparently to that last phrase, the judge actually sustained the objection and then struck the entire response, which included a lot of information that was clearly admissible. So that's not really the focus of your argument, right?
No, the
fact that the bad man was stricken.
No, it's not really the focus, but it is important to the argument because, again, it goes to why it was so important to me to raise the issue that I think this jury thought the judge struck the entire explanation. Yeah.
Right. So that's the issue. I mean, judge's ruling had been, I'm striking the portion of the witness's response where he said the defendant was not a bad man, would we be here? I mean, you would have had the rest of the response. Would you be filing cert on just that issue?
No, not just that issue. No, I would not. But I felt it was something we should discuss, but I will talk about what you want me to talk about now, if that's the case. Because of course I said the second issue was whether the ICA really, I'm sorry. Actually, it was the third issue you're talking about. whether the ICA gravely erred in holding no reasonable jury could have concluded the trial court was instructing him to disregard the entire answer, as opposed to what we just talked about. Yeah, I think that's very important to this case. And it's related to what I was just talking about, and I'll explain why. I'm sorry, I have to drink a lot of water. It's some kind of medication I'm on.
I think Judge Nakamoto had a question also.
Mr. Jameson, Justice McKenna, are you able to see us? You're kind of in and out there. That's what you're a bit distracted. You can see our argument here? All right.
Yes.
Mr. Jameson, we're going to hear Judge Nakamoto's question. Judge Nakamoto.
So, Mr. Jameson, I guess just following up on Justice McKenna's inquiry, when they had the bench conference regarding the objection, and I know the trial judge indicated that he was striking just the last part of the instruction. And when I looked at it, it was clear that it was regarding the character evidence. But is part of your argument is that the jury might not have been privy to that conference. So in their minds, the entire response was stricken.
That's part of my reasoning in this case, because I think what the ICA seemed to be saying is no reasonable jury could have thought that the judge was striking the entire answer, because they had just heard Dr. Blinder say that to a reasonable degree of medical probability. He had just said that he's not a bad man who goes around hurting people. And then the prosecutor objected and said, I move to strike that last phrase. And then after a brief discussion at the bench, the judge came back and said, you are to disregard the last response. Okay. Now, the ICA seemed to be saying that based on those circumstances, how could any reasonable juror be confused as to what had been stricken? Why would they think it was the entire explanation and not just the phrase, he's not a bad person? The reason I say that is I would concede somebody could say, no problem. He just struck the last response. He just struck the phrase, he's not a bad person who goes around killing people, hurting people. If I was there, I would say, I'm not so sure. Number one, he didn't say that to us. He didn't tell us you are to disregard the phrase, he's not a bad person. That's number one. Number two, what I heard the prosecutor say, he was objecting to the last phrase. What I heard the judge say after a brief discussion to which we were not privy, he was asking us to disregard the last response. Now, I don't know about the rest of you, I would say, but to me, response is different from a phrase. At best, it's unclear. Is he striking the whole testimony, or is he just striking the part where he said he's not a bad person? So I say at that very point in the proceedings, a reasonable juror already could have had some questions about exactly what was stricken. But what happened just moments later, I think, made it very clear that the judge was striking the entire response. Because immediately after the judge had said to the jury, you know, disregard the last response, he told defense counsel to rephrase his question. The defense counsel did. And then the answer to the question was, where Dr. Blinder testified that, you know, he said that he was, to a reasonable degree of medical probability, there was no reasonable rational explanation for his actions. And but for them, his psychotic illness, he would not have taken the life of this man. And then he stopped. At which point the prosecutor moved to strike, at which point the jurors clearly, now this is what they also heard in their presence, the judge say, I know, I just struck it and I'll strike it again. The it he has to be referring to now at this point, because there's no mention whatsoever of character, is the explanation. And so now if there was any doubt, I don't think that a reasonable juror would have any doubts that we're not just to disregard the part where he said he's not a bad man who goes around. We just heard the judge say, I struck it, meaning what he just told us before, his explanation and his conclusion. And so that's why I disregard where we're here.
Jameson, because that's Justice Edens has a question.
Mr. Jameson, what should the court have instructed the jury?
I think the court should have simply said, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, you are to disregard the doctor's statement that he is not a bad person who goes around killing, hurting people. Then there'd be no doubt. But now, are you talking about the second thing that Dr. Linder said, or to the first thing Dr.
The first said? And now the second. What would you have, what should the court have done with respect to the second issue?
On the grounds that was raised for the objection, overruled the objection. This thing, it was not speculative. It was based on an examination of the data. He speculated when you're talking out of thin air, but this doctor was saying he had already said he looked at the medical reports in this case. He looked at the police reports. He talked to the defendant. So he wasn't speculating about the best explanation being the mental illness. He was giving an opinion he was entitled to explain, by the way, under 704-401.
So in that case, the judge should not have even sustained the objection. But what about the first one? You know, you don't, and the prosecution points this out in its briefing. It says you don't seem to really contest the character evidence, but, you know, in your prefatory remarks here, you were saying that, you know, this was a Dr. Blinder's sort of explanatory style and how he is explaining things. And I think what Dr. Blinder testifies to is when he first gets a case, he looks at sort of if there is some sort of a reasonable explanation or rationale for the conduct, and he used the examples of racial animus or a drug deal. Is his comment really character evidence when he says, you know, he's not a bad man who goes around hurting people? Is there a difference between a bad man, a good man, a man? I mean, is that really character evidence?
Let me say this way. It is, in a way, character evidence. It's admissible character evidence. And again, I'd like to explain why. I think what Dr. Blinder is saying, and I am paraphrasing, but I'm taking what he said, which is what an attorney would do, and use it in closing. Dr. Blinder is saying, as again, I looked at everything in this case. The first response I get is, this guy is not criminally responsible because he believed that he had a divine mission from God and God was sanctioning what he did. That would explain this homicide in this case. But that's not good enough. You've got to try and disprove that. And the reason you want to disprove that rather than prove it is you don't want to run into any what we call confirmatory bias, right? So you try to find a way to prove it's not the mental illness. And the way to do that, I think Dr. Blinder seems to be saying, is try to look for something that could have occurred that had nothing to do with the mental illness. In this case, let's say for the sake of argument, the insult on the bus. The problem with that insult is that's not enough of a way to disconfirm. Because while it is true that maybe the reason he reacted the way he did was because he, excuse my language, but maybe the victim, Alex Cerizo, had called him a pussy and challenged him to a fight and then refused to fight him when he got off the bus. Okay, that would explain why he might get angry with him, but it would not explain the degree of his reaction. Okay, it's not enough to have the trigger. You got to try and explain what is it, why, how do you explain this reaction? Most people, if you call them a pussy, they might argue with you, they might punch you, they might kick you, they might, depending on how angry they get. This person, I mean, Kumulipo Silva didn't do that. He nearly decapitated this man. So the trigger isn't enough. Is there something about Silva? Is he someone who is easily offended and prone to violence? Because if you have that in this case, and you have a trigger, then that disproves the mental illness. And so that's what he was looking for.
Correct then in understanding your argument to be that, you know, while it might be character evidence, you know, this is just part of the basis of his opinion, and therefore it's admissible and the jury can give it whatever weight it deems appropriate.
That's part of it. And that's why it was confusing, because when Judge Bisson struck the testimony, the prosecutor had not stated the grounds for why he wanted the evidence stricken. Judge Bisson, I suppose, could have turned to the prosecutor and said, what exactly do you want me to strike and why? What's your ground? But he didn't do that. He asked defense counsel if there was any objections, and this defense counsel was confused at that point. He said, what are the grounds? So then the judge struck it because it was essentially non-responsive. But like you point out, Justice, it was actually part of the response, you know, and to me, it was an important response. So that's my answer to your question. Yes, it was part of the response. And I think the ICA recognized that the the lower court was wrong for striking it on the grounds it was non-responsive, because they made no mention of it in why they said there was no error. They said it was no error because this was barred under 404A, but I say they made a mistake because it was admissible under 404A.
Mr. Jameson, Justice McKenna has a question. Oh, Justice McKenna, you're muted. I'm sorry.
Mr. Jameson, I thought you were also raising 704.410 subsection 4. Why are we talking about Rule 404 when 704.410 subsection 4 says when an examiner testifies, the examiner shall be permitted to make any explanation reasonably serving to clarify the examiner's diagnosis and opinion, and may be cross-examined as to any matter bearing on the examiner's competency. But in any event, it appears that this statute is directly on point as to the nature of an examiner's testimony. And 404 is a general statute. This is the specific statute that says an examiner is permitted to make any explanation reasonably serving to clarify the examiner's diagnosis and opinion. And so if the examiner's opinion is he's not a bad person that goes around hurting people all the time, I thought it was your argument that this is a part of that.
It is, but I just wanted to, it's to me clear, like you point out, under 704.410.4, I think you're referring to that. Yeah, this is part of his opinion, and the words of the statute, he shall be allowed to whatever the grounds he may have, because he can be cross-examined now. Okay. But I just wanted to stress upon the court that, you know, to begin with, that the testimony about he's not a bad person should not have been stricken in the first place. You know, not just because of 410, but because you'd be able to see that this is not character. This is admissible character evidence because it's pertinent to his explanation or his, as you point out, 704.410, right to explain his opinion.
Mr. Jameson, what's your response to the ICA's suggestion that even if there was error or when the judge issued his second ruling, striking testimony, which you believe struck the first answer or indicated to the jury the first answer was stricken in its entirety. What's your response to the suggestion that it's harmless error? I know the ICA refers to some testimony during cross where Dr. Blinder does talk again about, but for a psychosis, they would not have killed. So that issue kind of comes back in later. What's your response to the suggestion that it's harmless error?
I will concede that when I first looked at the ICA's reasoning, I thought they've got something here because it's right. Before anything was stricken, I think almost at the beginning of Dr. Blinder's testimony, he did say clearly he utterly lacked criminal responsibility, you know, when he was asked that question. So the jury heard that. The jury also heard Dr. Blinder say, and this was before anything was stricken, that at the time of the commission of the offense, he was psychotic. The jury also heard how the psychosis affected his brain and why he, you know, and that, of course, was relevant. Was he at the time under a mental illness? And the jury hears that. The next thing the jury hears, which is essential to this case, is as a result of that mental disease, disorder, or defect, he lacked responsibility. The jury heard all that. And then, as you pointed out, Chief Justice, on cross-examination, at some point in the cross-examination, the prosecutor raises the issue again of the what Dr. Blinder, I think, characterized as a non-mental illness explanation. The first thing I like to say about the first three things I said, that the jury did hear that he utterly, from this witness, he defendant utterly lack responsibility and so forth. Those are conclusions, you know, and conclusions certainly are good to know because those are the issues in this case, but you want the jury to know. It's not just the conclusion, you want the jury to know why. Why are you telling us that this man was not impaired? So to hear the conclusion as they heard, he wasn't, is not good enough. You would need the explanation. Now, getting to your question, when the prosecutor raised the issue on cross, I would state this. I think the prosecutor did it in a very misleading way. because the way the prosecutor did it was to point out that Dr. Blinder has pointed out, did say, although it appeared it might have been stricken, he did say, I think there was no rational explanation for this, right? So they bring that up. And then he puts a hypothetical to the doctor, which to me is somewhat misleading, because the hypothetical he puts to the doctor is to assume that when Mr. Cerezo and Kyle Keohu got on the bus, they at some point there was some kind of exchange between them and Mr. Silva. And what the dispute was about on the bus was supposedly, again, excuse my language, Cerezo saying that, calling Mr. Silva a pussy and saying that, threatening to beat him up. And then later on, when Mr. Silva wanted to accommodate him, he just walked away. Okay. Now, when he brings it up that way, what the reason I say is misleading, because unless you showed that Mr. Silva heard what Mr. Cerezo was saying about him, that theory would fall flat. Now, I don't recall any part in Mr. Cerezo's testimony where he said that, clearly said to the jury, that what he was calling Mr. Silva, i.e. a pussy, and the things he was saying, was ever said so that Mr. Silva heard that. All you had to do was ask him, did Mr. Silva seem to hear what he said? Or where was Mr. Silva standing? Or did you address those words to Mr. Silva? Or were you talking to yourself and Kyle Keohu? If Mr. Silva never heard the words, then the idea that it was the insult that sent him over the edge would fall apart. That was not part of the hypo. And I don't think Dr. Linder could see that coming, you know, because of course he would say, well, yeah, sure, you think about it, but that's not what happened in this case. I think what Dr. Blinder said happened in this case, the anger that he saw displayed by the defendant comes from, he doesn't say it as clearly as I do, I will say that, but I know it's in the evidence. The anger came from Mr. Silva experiencing a hallucination at the time. Mr. Silva was looking at poor Mr. Cerezo, and he saw Mr. Cerezo doing something Mr. Cerezo wasn't doing. He saw Mr. Cerezo threatening some human beings, right? And so that's why Mr. Silva was so angry, not because he called him a pussy, but because there was a demon who he said had taken his life in a prior life, a demon that he had extracted and sent to moon, and now he is back doing the same thing and threatening people. That's insane, okay? So I think that Dr. Durden was misled, you know, when they were just trying to make it look like there was these words and it was never communicated.
Mr. Jamieson, we're at about 25 minutes. Do you want to briefly address the jury instruction issue, or just rely on your briefs on that? And then, or is there anything else you want to raise to us at this time?
Am I at the 25 minutes?
25:43.
Oh, I'll just rely on this point. I'm sorry. Thank you.
No, I mean, feel free if you want to address it briefly. It's okay.
Well, I'll just briefly say this. When you tell the jury that before they apply insanity, they must decide whether or not they have a murder. If you tell the jury that, and there's also evidence of an extreme mental or emotional disturbance, they can't possibly apply insanity until they answer the question of whether or not there was extreme mental emotional disturbance, because you don't know what you have until you address that question. That is why I think you need to address the issue first. The second thing is because I think that if you don't instruct that they should apply insanity to what he was found guilty of, you deprive him of his right to put on a complete defense. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you very much, Mr. Jamieson. We'll turn to Mr. Ross at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. excuse me. The first thing I'd like to address is this argument about the bad man remark being stricken. My first problem with that argument is that it's not in petitioner's petition for certiorari. Mr. Jamieson characterized this as there being three issues. If we look at page one of the application, there's two issues. There's whether the ICA committed grave error when they concluded the circuit court did not strike Dr. Blinder's testimony. And then two is the jury instruction question. That is the issue of whether or not this bad man testimony was improperly stricken was not raised. The court did not grant certiorari on that issue. I certainly didn't address it in my response to the application because it was not raised. I don't know what else there is to say about it, but this is the first time petitioners tried to raise that issue before this court. So I'd urge the court not to to take up that argument. Now, since it's been raised, I will say a few things about it. I think it was completely appropriate for the court to strike that testimony. Whether or not, as the court said in the conference at the bench, whether or not Mr. Silva is a good man, a bad man, that's irrelevant. That's not the issue. The issue is whether or not he was insane at the time of the crime. So I don't see that as, more to the point, I don't see that as something Dr. Blinder can give an opinion on, whether or not he's a bad man. That's not something that they've established foundation for him to talk about. That's not something he was certified as an expert to talk about. He's testifying as to whether or not Mr. Silva has a mental issue, not whether or not Mr. Silva is a good person. Going to the issue of whether or not he's allowed to testify about anything that supports his opinion, I don't think that's reasonably related to his opinion. His opinion that Mr. Silva was suffering from a mental disease at the time of the crime doesn't rely on whether or not Mr. Silva is a bad man. So I think for all those reasons, the circuit court was right to strike that particular part.
Mr. Ross, what's your response with regard to the other testimony that came at just about the same time? Absent for that nutty, crazy thing, he wouldn't have hurt anybody. And then later on, but for his psychotic illness, he would not have taken the life of this man. Was that properly excluded or not in your view?
I think that was properly excluded. When it comes up the second time it's been talked about, the circuit court said it's his opinion that he suffers from a mental disease. He's adding on to the end of that answer. The objection was that it was speculative, and I think that's correct. It is speculative for Dr. Blinder's opinion is Mr. Silva has this disease. It's impossible for Dr. Blinder to be saying what Mr. Silva would or would not have done absent having this disease. So I think it was speculative, and I think it was appropriate for the circuit court to strike that on that basis, because Dr. Blinder's entire testimony is based upon the presupposition that Mr. Silva is suffering from this mental disease. So to have him start talking about what may or may not have happened absent that mental disease, I don't think that's appropriate. And I think the circuit court was right to strike it.
Justice McKenna has a question.
I want to make sure I understand your argument, Mr. Ross. You're arguing that a psychiatric or psychological expert cannot testify that absent the mental disease, it wouldn't have happened?
I don't think they can do that, because their testimony is he had this mental disease. Therefore, he took these actions.
So you're saying that they can only testify in the form of the way 704 defenses are presented, that they didn't have the capacity to conform his conduct to the requirements of the law.
Well, I think he can only testify as to his opinion as to Mr. Silva had this mental disease, which caused him to take these actions. I think for him to be talking about what would have happened if Mr. Silva didn't have this mental disease is inappropriate, because no one knows. We don't exist in that universe according to Dr. Blinder.
That's what these psychological experts are always testifying to, that if they didn't have this mental disease, they wouldn't have performed the action. Isn't that the other side of the testimony?
Yeah, it's the other side of the testimony. I think the jury can maybe draw that conclusion from the testimony. But Dr. Blinder is being certified to testify as to what Mr. Silva's mental state was, not what Mr. Silva would have done absent that mental state that Dr. Blinder says he has. So
that's not my understanding of 704 defenses. Isn't it the statute says that they can testify as to defendant's responsibility for conduct alleged or the issue of the defendant's capacity well, the defendant's responsibility for conduct alleged. So isn't that part and parcel of the defendant's responsibility for the conduct alleged? I mean, that's the statute says that's what they get to testify to.
Right. And he did testify to that. He testified he had a mental disease, which resulted in him not having capacity. I don't think you need to go down the, once you've said that, once you've said this crime was the result of him having a mental disease, you don't need to go into this speculative, well, if he had, if he didn't have that mental disease, he would have done X, Y, or Z. Because that doesn't help the jury decide whether or not the mental disease or defect was the cause of the crime, because either he has it or he doesn't. So talking about, once it's your opinion that he has it, why are you talking about what he would have done absent the disease?
All right. It appears that we have a fundamental disagreement on what the defense is and what an expert can testify to under Chapter 704. So we'll just leave it at that.
Mr. Rose, Justice Edens has a question.
Mr. Ross, it seems like, you know, the IC is avoiding deciding what a reasonable jury would understand what the judge's instructions were. I mean, they say it was cumulative, so, and it was, you know, it was harmless. I mean, doesn't the ICA suggest, by sort of ducking the issue about whether there was ambiguity or a dispute, doesn't it seem like they may have issues with how the jury could have understood what the judge's instruction was?
Are we talking about the second time it comes up, or the first?
I'm talking about both. I mean, you know, because some, I'm talking about both.
I think that the ICA, I think, only said it was cumulative as to the second part. I think on the first part, they concluded that the no reasonable juror would have concluded that the entire answer would have been stricken based on the way the objection was made and how Dr. Blinder's testimony.
Okay. Thank you for clarifying that. Let me ask you this though. Let's say, you know, I mean, in the real world, there's jurors and they go backstage, they listen to the judge's instructions, they get back there. And, you know, juror four is starting to discuss Dr. Blinder's testimony. And he's saying, you know, well, Dr. Blinder said, you know, in Silva's delusional mind, there's a dangerous demon. He's been anointed by the Bible to take care of this problem. But juror number six was, hey, time out. The judge struck that entire last response. But then juror nine says, no, you know, that was just the last phrase that was struck. And then juror three says, no, everything was stricken earlier. Remember when he said, I struck it earlier? I mean, then the jurors start discussing, you know, what the judge really meant. I mean, they're supposed to decide the facts, apply the evidence to the law, but it seems like, you know, they might be getting back there trying to fact find on what the judge actually told them to do. How do you resolve that possibility?
Well, I think the way I resolve that possibility is that, let's say the jurors assumed that entire first answer was stricken. The Dr. Winder's entire explanation went out the window because, yeah, I will concede that instruction, last phrase, last response, it's not a model of clarity. The court could have done things differently and said, okay, everything after this sentence is stricken or something like that. Even if we assume the jury thought the entire answer was stricken, which I'm not conceding, I think the ICA was correct on that issue, but even if we assume that, if we compare what Dr. Blinder said in that answer to other parts of his testimony that came in, they're the same. He testified, the entire answer that we're talking about up until the bad man part is him saying, what he does is he looks for a rational basis for the crime. Something, and he gives the example of a drug deal going bad or a racial insult. All that comes up later. He testifies to that in cross, the fact that he looks for a rational basis, the example of the drug deal gone bad, the example of the racial insult. So
it doesn't seem that his earlier testimony or his later testimony was tethered to the demon remarks. It seems that the demon remarks remarks that he made, which, if the last response was stricken, are not there to inform his opinion. So that does not suggest that that piece is cumulative.
I was of the belief there was another comment about the demon testimony somewhere, or the demon remark somewhere in testimony. But even if we look at what he says on page 42, I believe, of his testimony, I what he's trying to get across, I think, is he looks for this reasonable basis, and that's what he goes on about it at length, and that's what comes out repeatedly. So because the jury heard that at other points, I think there's no harm in it, even if we assume that entire answer was stricken.
If they heard it from other points from other witnesses, it wouldn't be cumulative, would it?
It wouldn't be cumulative as Dr. Blinder's opinion, but I think Dr. Blinder's testimony got all of that, all the relevant parts of his opinion out at various times.
Justice McKenna has a question. Justice McKenna?
So, Mr. Ross, it seems to me that you are arguing that even if a judge erroneously prohibits the defense from presenting part of the defense theory or the defense's evidence, as long as it comes up through the state's cross-examination, it's okay, it's harmless.
I think as long as Dr. Blinder's testimony and his opinion got into evidence, then it's harmless. Whether it's brought up by the state on cross or the defense on redirect, or
so it is the state's position that as long as what the defense was precluded from presenting is presented through the state, then it's harmless. That is one of your positions.
Yes, I would say so. And
so you think that a defendant's constitutional right to present a complete defense is satisfied if the state somehow can allude to that testimony?
I think his right to present a complete defense is not violated if the evidence that he wants to come in comes in
through the state. And of course, we're looking at a plain record, a transcript here. We have no idea the type of tone or inflection a prosecutor might be using when presenting evidence in front of the jury. But as long as the prosecutor refers to it, it's harmless. That's the state.
No, not as long as the prosecutor refers to it, as long as the witness gets to testify about it. And that's what Dr. Blinder did.
And it's no longer a defense's right to present a complete defense. In other words, the defense does not have the right to present a complete defense.
No,
it can be satisfied by the state.
I'm absolutely not saying that. I'm saying that the right is not violated de minimis fashion if the evidence comes in, even if it's introduced by the state.
And you expect a jury to understand that when the state presents evidence, that the state might be trying to present evidence that is favorable to a defendant. And the jury would not be thinking that evidence presented might inure to the benefit of the state. I'm having a lot of difficulty understanding why this government can argue that the right to present a complete defense can be satisfied by the state presenting the evidence. And it is not the constitutional right of the defendant to present that defense.
Well, because the right is to have Dr. Blinder testify to his opinion and his belief that Mr. Silva was operating under a mental disease when he committed this murder or this homicide. Dr. Blinder did that. So to expect the jury is instructed to consider all the evidence, regardless of who brings it in, the state, the defendant. So
if the jury is following their instructions, they're going to consider what Dr. Blunder said on direct. They're going to consider what Dr. Blunder said on cross and use it all when they're making their determinations. So I don't see it as a violation of Mr. Silva's right to present a defense if Dr. Blunder's answer is stricken, but then he says the exact same thing that he was saying in the stricken response later on cross. I just don't see that as being a violation of his rights. Once the evidence comes in, the jury's supposed to consider it, and his unstricken answers on that point came in.
Mr. Rost, I want to take you back to, again, as everyone's alluded to, both you and Mr. James, so there's sort of two engagements between the judge and the lawyers about this testimony. The first one, which we talked about, resulted in this in the last response being stricken, and then the defense counsel sort of goes into that issue again, and there the judge states that I ordered it stricken earlier. I'll order it stricken again. What do you think a reasonable jury would understand by the reference to "I'll order it stricken"? Do you think it's something other than that entire prior answer? And if so, how do you get to that?
Well, I do think it's something other than the entire prior answer. And I think that based on the sentence before "I ordered it stricken" earlier, the judge says he's adding on to at the end of the answer. And before that, he says it's his opinion he suffers from a mental disease, and he's giving a conclusion or opinion about that. And then he says he's adding on to the end of the answer. So, and then he says, I ordered it stricken earlier. So he's obviously saying he's adding on, he's allowed to testify as to this opinion that Mr. Silva suffers from a mental disease. It's the adding on to the end of that opinion that's the problem. So I think this clarifies what the court is doing, because he's saying, yes, he can give his opinion. He's got a mental disease. He's not allowed to go into this speculative testimony about what might have happened absent the mental disease. So that's why he's striking it. So I think if anything.
So the add-on is a reference to that's nutty and it's crazy. And absent that nutty, crazy thing, you wouldn't have heard anybody's not, a bad man who goes around hurting people. That's what you think the judge was referring to in context?
In this is the second part, I believe, the second objection, where the second part they're talking about is, and it, but for his psychotic illness, he would not have taken the life of this man. Because the full answer is, to a reasonable degree of medical certainty, there does not appear to be a rational basis for his action. That's the part that he's allowed to testify to when the judge says he's giving his opinion he suffers from a mental disease. It's the second part where he's saying, but for the psychotic illness, he would not have taken the life of this man. That's what he's saying he's adding on to the end of the answer. That's what he's saying he's striking. So I think that, if anything, it clarified to the jury, yes, listen to when you listen to Dr. Blunder's opinion that Mr. Silva suffers from this mental disease, but not this other part about what would have happened absent
that. Justice McKenna has a question. Justice McKenna. Oh, you're muted, Justice McKenna. Sorry.
I'm so sorry. I don't know why I'm having this problem today. But I think, with respect to Justice Edens pointed out that even if this, to a reasonable degree of medical probability, there does not appear to be a rational basis for his action. And if that now is considered to have been in, and only this, but for his psychotic illness, he would not have taken the life of this man. That was all that was excluded. There is the fact that all the discussion about demons that of Dr. Bivens was actually, Blunder was actually excluded. But I just wanted to clarify this comment from the court. I know I heard, it's his opinion that he suffers from a mental illness, and he's given a conclusion, or excuse me, the word opinion about that. He's adding on to that at the end of the answer. I ordered it stricken earlier. I'll order it stricken again. So this was in front of the jury, right?
Yes.
Okay. So is the judge kind of, all right. So the judge is giving his interpretation of the doctor's testimony or opinion here?
I would say he's describing the answer that he just gave and explaining which part he thinks is inappropriate.
Are judges supposed to be commenting on the evidence?
Well, I don't think it's a comment on the evidence. I think he's saying which part he's striking it versus the part he's allowing, which I think is.
But you think this exchange is absolutely makes it clear that the initial ruling to strike the response did not include everything. So the jury is supposed to glean from this that, it was only the last, you know, portion of the last long answer that was actually stricken. This makes it absolutely clear.
I don't think it makes it absolutely clear. I'm not going to sit here and tell you that this, anything that happened here was a model of clarity. I do think this helps make it more apparent what the court was actually doing, though.
In this case, we had three experts, correct?
Yes.
One other expert testified that he did not have penal responsibility, correct?
Yes.
And one expert testified that he did have penal responsibility.
Correct.
So if Dr. Blinder's testimony was stricken, you have a 1-to-1 instead of a 2-to-1. Is that right?
If you struck all of Dr. Blinder's testimony, then
right. All the stuff about the demons was actually stricken, then you have a 1-to-1 instead of a 2-to-1.
Yeah. If everything Dr. Blinder said as far as his opinion goes was stricken, then there was one expert on each side. Yes.
Justice Edens has a question. Justice Edens.
You know, when I look at Rule 403, we're talking about bad acts, unfair prejudice, forbidden inferences, hostility, sympathy, the nature of misleading evidence, those types of things. Then we have cumulativeness. And, you know, I mean, is that not really on the same level as some of the other, you know, forbidden 403 ways to preclude evidence?
Is cumulativeness as on the same level as other issues under 403? Is that the question? I'm sorry.
Yes. I mean, prejudice-wise.
I think it can be. I think it's going to depend on the situation.
And, you know, and sort of circling back to one of the questions I asked you about, you know, the cumulative nature of the demons comment. And it also sort of touches upon what Justice McKenna was talking about. As I sort of have quickly refreshed my memory of what Dr. Blinder testified to on direct and then cross, it seems that he only talks about the demons on direct, and that's the part that possibly, given the last response comment, would have been stricken. And then it is brought up on cross. There's some demon talk. But again, doesn't the defense have the right to present the evidence and present the case the way they want to? And again, it might be a duplicative question of Justice McKenna, but in looking at the transcript again, it just suggests that Dr. Blinder's tethering of the demons to his ultimate opinion about the lack of penal responsibility was so closely related, and then maybe it only came out on cross. Do you have any response to that?
Yes. Well, I have a couple of responses to that. I know Dr. Blinder testified about hallucinations, command hallucinations, things like that in various parts on direct. I mean, not including the answers that were stricken. So that those issues were discussed to some extent. I think another part of that answer is the judge never precluded the defendants from going back and asking whatever questions they might have had about these demon beliefs that Mr. Silva may have had. I can't really say why that wasn't asked again later, but that wasn't something where the judge said, you're flatly precluded from having Dr. Blinder testify about Mr. Silva's demon-related beliefs or anything. There was no obstacle to them doing that. So I don't think it's reasonable to say that they were precluded from doing that just because this one answer may or may not have been stricken. The conference at the bench on the first answer made it crystal clear what the court was intending to strike and what the court was not permitting Dr. Blinder to testify to. It was the bad man remark. Everything else in that answer was not a problem, and that was clear to defense counsel. So if he thought the instruction was unclear, he should have objected to that. That's another issue that we raised. But more to the point, there was nothing stopping him from going back to the well on those various issues if he saw it discussed.
You know, that's, you mentioned that that's another issue we raise, and I think that's the objection issue about the waiving objection. But isn't it the court's responsibility to instruct the jury properly, even absent an objection?
Well, yes, I think the court has that obligation. But all, at the same time, if the defense counsel thinks there's something improper about the instruction, since they were just at the bench, they know what the court is trying to do. I think it's incumbent on them to raise the objection and say, no, Your Honor, we need to clarify what's being stricken here, if they're going to raise it again later on appeal.
Mr. Rost, I want to ask you, one of the big issues, I guess, between the experts was the question about the significance of Mr. Silva's actions after the stabbing, you know, running away, hiding the knife, hiding his clothing. Was that something that Dr. Blinder was restricted from addressing, or was that something that was in essence fully aired out as part of the defense case in chief?
Well, he certainly wasn't restricted from addressing that. I know he was certainly cross-examined about that issue, and there was nothing from the judge's rulings would have prevented the defense from raising that issue.
And then do you want to address, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I think I was going to the same place you are, which is why I'd like to briefly address the jury instruction issue.
Yes, please, that's what I was going to suggest.
I don't think that argument has any basis whatsoever. The court did what was appropriate, which is you tell the jurors to consider the complete defense before you tell them to consider the mitigating defense. The complete defense of insanity needs to be decided before they decide EMED. You don't want them to be trying to figure out EMED if it's going to be rendered completely irrelevant by their determination on the insanity defense. There's no case law anywhere that I've ever seen that even remotely supports the idea that you've got to instruct them on EMED and have them convict the defendant of EMED manslaughter before they go and consider the insanity defense. Justice Nakayama's concurring opinion in State versus Yusugi and Justice Akoba's concurring opinion in State versus Yamada both say what happened here is the correct approach. You tell the jury, decide whether or not he's carried his burden on the insanity defense, and then you can go on. And if you say no, then you can go on and consider EMED. That's the proper approach. The petitioner has never addressed those arguments that the state has made relying on Yusugi and Yamada either in there. They didn't file a reply below, and then they didn't address it in their petition for certiorari. So I think I know concurring opinions aren't binding, but I think the logic is pretty unassailable that the proper way to do it is have them decide the complete defenses first so they don't waste time and get confused on the mitigating defense.
Very well, anything further for the court at this time to wrap up, Mr. Ross?
No, thank you, Mr. Chief Justice.
Very well. Mr. Jameson, your rebuttal. Mr. Jameson, you're muted, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. The issue that I think is bothering it, I hope it's bothering the court, is the very real possibility that this jury may have considered that they could not consider Dr. Blinder's explanation as to how he arrived at his conclusion or opinion that this defendant was not criminally responsible. That's very troublesome because, as I said earlier, as a defense attorney, you don't want to just argue, I have an expert who backs me up because he said what we need him to say. You want the jury to trust what the expert says. And the best way to trust what the expert says is to examine how he went about reaching the opinion that he wants you to believe. And I think that in this particular case, the way what probably I believe the jury thought was excluded was Dr. Blinder's, granted, I will say he didn't say it as clearly as I'm saying it, but I think somebody on the jury could have said, Dr. Blinder is probably a better witness here. Because what Dr. Blinder did was this. He looked at everything and it looked like the best explanation for the violence in this case was that Mr. Silva was psychotic at the time. But he did something else. To make sure that that was something that we should accept, he tried to disprove it. And how he tried to disprove it was by looking for something other than the mental illness to explain why he was so angry, and also to look at how it would have, whether that trigger could account for the degree of violence we saw in this case. And that's why, if you take away his explanation and you put the burden on the defense in this case, as the defense did have the case, it cannot possibly be harmless. It cannot possibly be harmless because it gives the state a one up. They get to hear Dr. Troy's explanation as to how he arrived at his verdict, but they don't get to hear Dr. Blindis, who looks like the better, more qualified witness, I should say, just objectively speaking. And they don't get to consider Dr. Choi was trying to prove that it was not a mental illness, so he needed a trigger and he found one. The problem was he ran into the confirmation bias. He forgot to look for the connection between the threat and whether the defendant heard it. And he also forgot to look like, how could the death insult alone account for such a violent response? The way to account for the violence response is to look for something in the defendant's character, which is what Dr. Blinder did, and to make sure that we don't have that here. Because only then can you be confident that he lacked criminal responsibility.
Mr. Jacobson, I asked this of Mr. Rost as well. I mean, a major issue between the two doctors was whether he could conform his conduct to the law. And I think Dr. Choi, if I understand, relied in part at least on the behavior of the defendant afterwards, the running away, hiding the knife, hiding the jacket. And that appears to be something that Dr. Blinder was allowed to testify to. So if that's really one of the key points of discussion, is that was there an adequate ability for the defendant to address that, or do you think the ability to address it was inadequate?
My recollection from the transcripts in this case, I know what you're talking about. Dr. Blinder was asked to explain what happened after the homicide. And I'm talking about the fact that the defendant fled the scene and he got rid of the evidence. The way I saw that, excuse me. I'm sorry, but I did not see that as a voluntariness issue. Because yes, it was very clear. I see there's no question that there was volition here because this man wasn't sleepwalking. You know, the issue that I saw was whether or not he could appreciate that what he was, it was wrong to kill the victim.
Right. So I guess the argument was it reflects consciousness of guilt, I guess.
Right. And I think I will concede that Dr. Linder said, no, there wasn't evidence that he knew what he was doing was wrong. It was part of his mental illness. You know, he was part of his mission to get rid of demons. The police may not share in the same belief that he's, and they may not even know that he's trying to help the human race. That's why Dr. Linder emphasized the witness in the bathroom. It was a demon, you know, because people like the police who are not demons, some are not, but those who are not would think he did something wrong because they don't understand it. That was how Dr. Blinder addressed that issue. And I would have to concede that he had an opportunity to do that. But I still think he had to have the jury should have been allowed to fully understand exactly what he was telling them so defense counsel could have used that to meet his burden. Because it did look like it, if you take Dr. Blinder out, you've got Dr. Choi versus Dr. Vargo. There's some problems with Dr. Vargo. She had cut and paste. She had looked like she left some stuff out. She wasn't as that strong a witness as Blinder was. So take Blinder out, you've got a problem for the defense, especially when you have the burden. And I think that's exactly what that the jury probably did in this case, is considered we cannot think about his explanation, only choice. Thank you.
Yeah. Anything further for the court at this time, Mr. Jameson? Nope, you're muted again, Mr. Jameson, sorry.
Well, I think it's just more sensible to do the EMED first, because once you know you have the EMED, you know exactly what you're dealing with, and you're not going to deprive him of his right to present a complete defense, because now you know what you're dealing with, and if in fact he's insane, he should not be sent to prison. And we know we only can do that for sure when we know what he has. And we won't know it until they decide that issue. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you to both of our attorneys for your arguments today. The court will take this matter under advisement.
Thank you.
Ua ho'oku ia mai ne, ke a aha ho'okolokolo ki ike hanohano okamoku aina o Hawaii. This Honorable Supreme Court of State of Hawaii is now adjourned.